Well, hi there. Welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I am reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest on this episode is Ben DiBono of the Sci-Fi Christian, and we are going to be talking about Lord of Light from Roger Zelazny, winner of the 1968 Hugo Award. So, Ben, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I've been wanting to get you on. You were one of the early people that I reached out to, you and Matt, actually. So I have had you on Take Me to Your Reader before, and so any listeners who have come over from there already know who you are, but for those who don't, why don't you tell me a little bit about where people might know you from?
Well, I'm the co-host with, you just mentioned him, Matt Anderson, over on the Sci-Fi Christian podcast. I don't know if he's been on your show yet or not, but you'll hear...
Not yet.
Okay, so when he is, your audience will get to hear my other half of my podcast, the podcasting duo we make up over in the Sci-Fi Christian. And we cover just about everything over there. I mean, when we started, there really wasn't this whole kind of niche of a Christian geek podcast. I mean, there was a couple out there, but it was relatively rare. And now there's quite a few of us out there, but I like to think we still stand out. Matt and I are very different people, but I think we have pretty good chemistry together, and that's a lot of what makes the show work, is I think we're just good at being able to interact well together on just about any topic. We fight well together, we discuss well together, we have episodes that run the range from humorous to movie reviews to philosophical to just about everything. So I'm proud of the variety we have over there. So if people haven't heard the podcast, you can check it out at thescifichristian.com.
Cool. So how about some of your actual personal history outside of the podcasting? Where have you, are you a lifelong geek, nerd, anything like that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Actually, I know in a minute we're going to get to your question of how many Hugo Award winners I've read. I got to say, I have a number for you, but I'm a little unsure on that number because there's some of these that I think I might have read back in my teenage years, but it's I don't know for sure at this point. So there's a few I'm not sure on whether or not I've read. But yeah, I remember my dad reading Chronicles of Narnia to me as a kid, and reading Batman comics and all of that, and read a ton of sci-fi as a teenager, and a ton of comic books and all of that. And I still, I don't read quite as much these days of all that, but I do keep up with a lot of authors. A big fan of Dan Simmons, George R. R. Martin, obviously, Neil Gaiman. Who else do I read? Neil Stephenson, some of those big names. So, I would say that I qualify as a lifelong geek. This is, There's very few areas of fandom that I'm not at least mildly conversant in. Let's put it that way.
Nice. So, like you mentioned, you have counted up how many Hugo winners you have read, and at this point, I'm at 18. Which is up from 12 when I started. So, nice. Feeling good about that. But embarrass me with your number.
All right. So I have 35 that I've read. Nice. And then there are 5 that I have read at least part of. So 40 total that I've been exposed to, but 5 at least fractionally. So like I've tried Neuromancer a few times and I just cannot get into that book. I can respect it, but it does not click for me.
Yeah. I felt kind of similarly about that one because I did that one for an earlier episode and it didn't connect for me the way I thought, the way I kind of hoped it would. I want to like every book I read. And
exactly.
And that one, I was glad that I had a guest that was enthusiastic about it and could tell people about what they really like. So
now when you have Matt on, is he doing Red Shirts?
Yeah.
Okay, because that's one of my other 5, is I just tried to read Red Shirts, and I quit. I was listening to it on the audiobook. I quit after 20 minutes because I could not stand the writing. So I'm gonna have to go fight with him about that now.
Yeah, sounds good.
Because I know he was a big fan, so we'll have to bring that up after he's on.
I have heard mixed reviews of that audiobook. And
yeah, it's Will Wheaton, who I'm not a big fan of. Sure.
And I've just read it in print twice and enjoyed it a lot. But yeah, you can listen in and make fun of him when he posts the Red Shirts episode in your feed. So
oh yes, yeah, we'll have a good time with that.
Yeah, that's good. Well, so let's talk about this book in particular, Lord of Light. Why this book?
Yeah, so I would say looking over the novels I've read from the Hugo Award winners, this is probably my favorite of them. There's a couple others that would vie for that title. Hyperion. I'm a huge Dan Simmons fan. Mm-hmm. So I love Hyperion. And Dune would be the other one. I mean, there's a few that other ones that would need to be in that conversation as well. Ender's Game and Speaking for the Dead. I love both those books. Mm-hmm. But this is probably my favorite. I've read this book. I was trying to think. This is either my fourth or fifth reading of it over the years. I read it back, you know, when I was, like I said, going to town on every sci-fi book I could find as a 16, 17-year-old. So found it then, and it clicked for me. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff I enjoyed back then that, you know how it is. You pull it out 10 years later and it just doesn't work for you. This is one that I've pulled out, you know, every 3-4 years, and it still works, and it works on new levels, and I see new things in it. I love Roger Zelazny's prose. I love how influential this is on other books, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of that as we go on.
Yeah.
But this is a book that just, almost on an intangible level, really clicked for me almost instantly when I started reading it, and has never unclicked for me. So I love Lord of Light.
Cool. I really like to get somebody who's passionate about it, because you know, this is a first read for me, and so I have some thoughts, but it's still kind of one that I'm processing, and I think could definitely reward a reread.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a confusing book the first time you pick it up too.
I noticed that as well. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Well, on that topic, why don't we go into kind of our non-spoiler discussion of the book? So can you give a brief, I don't know, synopsis, elevator pitch? You know, what's the book about? Why would somebody want to read it?
Sure. So humanity has left Earth. They are now living on, well, I don't know that we ever find out the name of the world, but they're living on some distant planet that they have colonized. At least a fraction of the original humans who came on the ship however many generations ago have used technology to set themselves up as the Hindu pantheon, and they are suppressing technological development in the rest of the humans who no longer remember their origins on Earth. So they're living life high as the Hindu gods, and along comes one of them, who is our main character, who goes by the name of Sam, and he sets himself up as the Buddha in order to start a rebellion against the gods, and it unfolds from there. So that's probably about as much as you want to give without getting into plot details, because I think the fun of the novel is watching his rebellion unfold, and watching the different interactions. It's told non-linearly, so we pick it up towards the end of the story, and then a lot of it is flashbacks from Sam. And so figuring out the things in the initial chapter don't line up with how they are when we go into the flashbacks, especially with some of the allegiances of different characters. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of fun watching all of that shift and everything. Gets into ideas of humanity, of post-humans, of, you know, the famous Asimov quote about, or not Asimov,
Clark.
Our Clark quote about, you know where I'm going. About
sufficiently advanced technology.
Sufficiently advanced technology, indistinguishable from magic. So it gets into all of those themes. So, but it definitely not new themes for the experienced sci-fi reader, but Zelazny was one of the first to do them, in my opinion, the best to do them.
A little bit of trivia about this one that I learned while just kind of doing some Googling for it was that Lord of Light was actually, well, let's see. Have you ever seen the movie Argo?
Yes, I thought that was where you were going. This is a great story.
Yeah, that, you know, in the story of Argo, which is based on true events, I think it was American and Canadian folks that went into Iran to pull people out during the hostage crisis, under the guise of shooting a film called Argo, or codenamed Argo anyway, that was based on Lord of Light, which I think is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I was disappointed the novel didn't get a name drop in the movie.
Yeah, that is kind of a drag, but I thought that was a really cool little tidbit. I had no idea.
It is. It was one of those things that I had read years and years ago and thought was cool and everything, and they actually did some production sketches, so you can, you know, if you Google those online, you can go see what some of the production artwork was, because they had to make it seem like it was a real production in order to sell it to the Iranians. So I'd read it years and years ago, and then completely forgot about it, and then however many years ago it was now that Argo came out, when that movie was announced and I heard the plot, something clicked to me. is that Lord of Light? And I went and checked, and it was. And so that was kind of fun because I had known the inside story on that.
Yeah, as I understand it, it was actually they were actually using an actual screenplay treatment of Lord of Light as the basis for all that production design they had to start working on.
Yeah, and so I think that's correct.
Out there somewhere, but just has never come to fruition. So maybe we can circle back around to that and talk about if you'd like to see it adapted, and if so, in what form.
Yeah, I feel like, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like, and I'm just scanning the Wikipedia page and I'm not seeing a reference to it, but I think there was an idea of developing it into a theme park too at one point.
Oh, wild.
So I'll have to do a quick Google here at some point and figure out if I'm just speaking out of bad memory or if I'm actually right about that.
Yeah, you can always send me the link and I can drop it in the show notes.
Nice.
Cool. All right. Well, so overall thoughts on this book. I mean, you've obviously read it a number of times and are a big fan, but anything else you want to say kind of at the outset without getting too much into spoilers?
Sure. I mean, I think science fiction and, well, genre fiction in general can get a bad rap because a lot of times it's good ideas, but not great writing necessarily.
Yeah.
And I think that at times that's unfair. There are certainly great writers in the genre, but at times, I mean, to be even handed, there are certainly books that are cool, but do not stand up to any type of serious literary critique. Sure. And I feel like Roger Zelazny is one of the great wordsmiths of science fiction. I don't know if you've read the Amber Chronicles or any of his other works.
I haven't. I've seen you've been rereading them, I think, on Goodreads, right?
Yep, I reread them all last year, and it's another great work. But he just has a prose that really clicks for me. It's not complex and flowery. It's almost Hemingway-esque, not quite to that extreme where Hemingway is so stripped down with his prose, but it's a little bit like that where his books are short. It's the bare essentials. And there's just this beautiful simplicity to how he writes. I think that carries through into the structure of this novel where it's really not so much chapter one, chapter two. It's seven interconnected short stories, essentially, and they build on one another. But each story starts out a new time period and unknown amount of time has passed in the story, and it's a new setting and everything. And I like that style a lot. Yeah. I really love the theme of post-humans. I'm a big fan of Dan Simmons' novel Ilium, which I think I'd actually read before I read Lord of Light. I don't remember. I read them both around the same time. Mm-hmm. But that one, it's, again, post-human set up as the Greek pantheon, and so there's a lot of influence between this book and Ilium. So, without getting into spoilers and without just repeating what I've already said, I think the prose is absolutely beautiful in this novel, and almost hypnotic in the way he writes.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree. I really enjoyed it. It was a pleasure to read. And sometimes in science fiction, like you said, it can be big ideas, cool concepts, and clunky prose that just you have to get over in order to enjoy the story. Definitely not the case here. I thought it was definitely a pleasure to read. It was an interesting premise, not something that I'm terribly familiar with. It kind of has that genre straddling thing going on where there's not a lot of evidence of technology, for instance, in much of the story, other than the fact that there's some kind of technology that allows them to take on these divine aspects and reincarnate. But that's kind of behind, it's at one remove in a way.
Right.
Where most of the story is ground level, just people dealing with apparent magic.
Exactly. And that combination, anytime a sci-fi novel goes there, I really am drawn to that. Not to say that that's enough to paper over bad writing.
Sure.
I really enjoy that kind of straddling the line. And it really is a working out of that Clark quote we already mentioned.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, his other works like Amber, I think Amber there's not quite the same technological basis for what's going on in Amber, but there's a little bit of that same feel of straddling lines and are these people gods? Well, maybe not really. And so he does that really well. I feel like Neil Gaiman does that well also, though not so much with technology, but kind of, I don't know if you've read American Gods yet.
Yeah.
I think that's a Hugo winner, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So American Gods, obviously they're not using technology there, but it has kind of that similar feel where yes, they're gods, but they're also just kind of running around with us here and something about that I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you said, so kind of by way of overall thoughts on this one, this is not a novel that holds your hand.
Right.
He drops you right into it. And even kind of the little bits that you gave in the synopsis will help a first time reader, I think,
to
stick with it and understand. Because when I got to the second chapter in it, I was thrown for a while. I'm like, what is going on? It doesn't seem like this is building on what happened in the first chapter.
Right.
And that's because the first chapter is almost toward the end. And that's interesting. And I do like a nonlinear story. And I feel like it's executed well here, where you don't necessarily need to know exactly what's transpired in the kind of interstitials between the various times. You don't have to line it up and put it on a timeline and chart it out or anything like that. And it still works.
Right. And I think that this, if I believe with the publication history of Lord of Light, at least some of the stories were released independently in different sci-fi mags when he was writing it.
So interesting.
I believe the novel was... I don't think it was true of all of them, but some of the early chapters were released as independent short stories.
Hmm. Yeah, and like you said, the allegiances of some of the characters changed through the book. And so you're like, okay, well, this has got to be earlier because Yama is not yet on his side.
Right, yeah.
And in fact, it diametrically opposed. You know, they're actual enemies. So
right, Yama in chapter one versus chapter two could not be more different in terms of their feeling towards Sam, his feeling towards Sam.
Yeah.
I have an answer for you on the theme park one, if you want to get that in quick before we go.
Yeah, sure, go for it.
Okay, so it was going to be made into a theme park. What the deal was is that so this is all before Argo, when the movie was actually being developed, because the reason they chose Lord of Light for the Argo project is because it was a scrap sci-fi movie, so there was a lot of stuff already done. In fact, Jack Kirby, you know, the famous comic book artist, did a lot of the production sketches for it. So... The plan had been that they were going to do this movie and it was going to have a lot of elaborate sets and everything. And then they were going to use the sets to build a science fiction theme park in Colorado. So not only did we almost get a Lord of Light movie from the Star Wars era, we also almost got a Lord of Light theme park, which I don't know how that would have gone. And sci-fi Christian listeners know my feelings about theme parks, but
it can't be worse than Disney.
It would have been
right?
fun to see. Exactly. I'd rather go to Lord of Light Land than Disney World. I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, so then kind of one more thing to talk about in non-spoiler, like who would you recommend this novel to? Fans of other properties, novels, movies, whatever.
Yeah, I think that if you are, I've got to be a little cautious here because they're very different writers, but I feel like if you're fans of somebody like Neil Gaiman or Dan Simmons, even though their style is very different than Roger Zelazny, you're going to see a lot of Roger Zelazny in their work, or vice versa, if you've read them, then you're going to him. Hmm. So I would definitely recommend it to fans of either of those writers. I think anybody who sort of likes that science fiction genre straddling we talked about with fantasy and magic would like this. Anybody who enjoys tales of the gods, which I certainly do, you like mythology and you like a good dose of mythology in your science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to enjoy this. It has a nice war with the gods vibe, which I always find entertaining. So anybody who likes that type of stuff, if you want your science fiction to be ultra spelled out and hard, and you're a Werner Vinge fan and you want everything to at least theoretically make sense, you're probably going to be frustrated by Roger Zelazny, which I don't mean that as a swipe at Werner Vinge. I like him too, but just he's very... intelligent writer in the way he tries to detail things. Sure. Or Kim Stanley Robinson would be another good one with his Mars trilogy. If you're a fan of that type of science fiction and only that type of science fiction, you're going to find this too brief in terms of its scientific explanations or lack thereof. But for anybody else who's a fan of the genre, this is a classic and it's really a must read.
Agreed on every point. I mean, I know there are people who get stuck on one particular kind of science fiction and say, this is proper science fiction and that stuff over there. No, not so much. And
right.
I prefer a large umbrella.
Yep.
Room for hard, room for soft, everything in between.
Yeah. All the MIT grads out there probably have thumbed their nose at the likes of Lord of Light. But
right. Yeah. I get frustrated with hard science fiction, especially on a reread. I feel like something like The Martian, I really enjoyed that the first time I read it. And the second time I read it, I'm like, I'm getting bored with some of the tech stuff.
Yeah, it can go either way.
I'm a techo guy, too. So.
Right. Like, I love Neal Stephenson, and he gets into pretty hard science fiction, but I have never been able to make it through his Baroque cycle. I've tried a couple times, and that book is just so dense. He's not so much interested in telling the story as he is trying to recreate the 16th century Enlightenment setting. So he gets lost in the weeds on that one.
Interesting. All right. Well, I think it's time to get into spoiler talk. What do you think?
Perfect.
So pretty much just freeform discussion from here. We don't have to go on any particular structure, just anything that you want to talk about this book.
Yeah. So one of the things I really like is the way that this world unfolds and the way that we find out more about it. Like, once you kind of get your bearings with the novel, which, as we've said, takes a little time, especially on your first read.
Yeah.
There's this kind of gradual unfolding. So I think in chapter 3 or 4, we meet the demons and they turn, and there's an allusion to the demons in chapter 1. I think Tok sees Sam gambling with the demons at one point, but we don't find out any more about them. And then we find out that these were the original inhabitants of the planet, and they're energy beings or something, and only Sam was able to bind them and stick them away. And so there's that. And then you get characters like Agni, who emerges, he's such a great villain. You know, at least a cool villain. He doesn't have a whole lot of character to him, but to me, that makes him more menacing, where he has this mask that he wears, where he's controlling fire and everything. So you have this gradual unfolding, and then you have, I'm blanking on his name, but the one guy who emerges at the end, who is a Christian and is busy resurrecting a zombie army to go get involved here.
That was an interesting reveal there too, because you don't know about the Christianity aspect of it until toward the end.
Yes.
And I thought that was just a little backhand to Christians, but
yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think you do get kind of a feel that these people were of Western or European descent in this.
Yeah.
And so it kind of makes sense, because it's like they would have at least had the Judeo-Christian background.
Well, yeah. And I mean, even if you look at India, right, it's a diverse place in terms of faiths. It's a big melting pot.
So. Exactly. You know, and Sam even makes the point at one point, he has a joke where he says, well, I only chose Buddhism because Christianity or because crucifixion is painful. You know, it's like there were other options, but
yeah.
So I kind of like the idea that, there's an element of a slight backhand at Christianity, but I find it kind of cool, the idea that everybody else ran off and did the Hindu thing, and then this guy's been slowly going insane on his own over in his corner of the world because he wasn't ready to give up his Christianity.
Well, I thought it was interesting that he was presented as, like, both sides in this. We're like, well, we don't want to deal with that guy, but I guess if he has to fight on our side, that's fine for now. But then later on, you know, we got to put him down too.
Exactly.
And he sounds like this really evil guy, and they refer to him even with some, like, black monikers.
Yeah, Naridi the Black. That's his name.
Right. And then you find out, oh, he's a representative of Christianity trying to proselytize.
Right. So, well, so when proselytizing fails, you just employ your scientific magic and resurrect zombies to carry out the faith for you, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's one way to go.
I think that's in the Bible somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I really do like that Zelazny trusts the reader to go along with him.
Yes.
Kind of going back to that non-linear narrative, and just the fact that he drops you in it and it's like, you're going to come with me and you're going to like this. And I think the fact that his prose is so strong is what allows that to happen. Because I started reading it on a plane, and it wasn't the kind of prose that is effortless to read, but it drew me in. And so it was a nice thing actually to read on a plane, just to have the distraction, but I didn't just tear through it or anything. You know, it forced me to take my time. I ended up actually in the second chapter, I ended up flipping back to the first one just to make sure I hadn't missed something because of that time shift that's there, because it goes back in time substantially.
Yeah. And I mean, the time shift is flagged in the first chapter, but it's easy to miss it, because I think the first chapter ends with Sam looked up at the sky and remembered or something like that.
Yeah.
And so once you get what the novel's doing structurally, like, that makes perfect sense as a segue. But if you're just expecting to read like in any other novel, well, that doesn't necessarily signal a flashback, especially one that's going to last for the entire book.
The thing I wasn't really expecting from the way the book was being set up was how exciting some of the fight and war sequences were.
Yes.
Because I thought those were really, really skillfully done.
Right, especially the one outside of the demon's lair, and Krishna and Agni and Yama are all there, and Sam steals the chariot, and yeah, it gets pretty wild in places.
Well, and he's able to use that mechanic of reincarnation for them to allow Sam to fail a couple times.
Right.
And that was interesting, too.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves in this conversation, but when we look at the question of, would you want to see this adapted? Well, yeah, I mean, if it could be done right, there are really strong visuals in this novel that, if done right, and if done with proper story and character backing, would be absolutely incredible to see.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You know, like I said earlier, it's the book is still kind of sinking in, and I wish I would have been able to go back and pick it up and thumb through it a little bit more before we recorded, because I read it now a couple weeks ago. And I guess I'd say while I really enjoyed it, I think I need another read to really get it and to kind of figure out what the point is. And not that all science fiction has to have a point, of course.
Right.
But yeah, there were parts of it where like, I really enjoyed that. I'm not totally sure what it was about, but it was really good. So I don't know if you can help me out there.
No, I think that's good. I think it is a book that has to settle in with you a little bit. In terms of my experience with it, maybe that's where the way I read it, reading it, you know, when you're 16 years old, I just want cool stuff at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So I finished the book, and I couldn't care less what it means at that point. And it's just, wow, there's people with gods, and they got firepower and chariots, and isn't that cool? And so the book hooked me on that level. And then as I've been able to come back to it, it's settled in with me on rereadings, and I've seen some of the other stuff. I mean, I think that there's a couple things going on. I think Zelazny at times could be an experimental writer. And if you read some of his other books, like there's one that's kind of similar called Lords of Light and Dark or something like that, but it's far more experimental. There's not really much of a plot involved. And so he gets a little lost in the weeds. I mean, it's interesting and it's worth reading if you're a Zelazny fan. But some of his stuff like that gets lost in the weeds. Whereas this is kind of the happy medium for Zelazny. This is where his experimental tendencies in terms of structure and prose are firing on all cylinders, along with his world building and characters and story and all of that. So on some level, it's just a meeting of all of those different skills. I mean, I think it gets into ideas of what does it mean to be human? There's this whole concept of that as they're reincarnating, their bodies and their different characteristics are kind of reasserting themselves. And so on what level is ourself, does ourself exist? And what happens if you put yourself into a new body? To what degree are you a new person? To what degree are you still human? And I think that these are questions that are going to become more and more relevant as technology progresses. Not to say that we're going to be switching bodies like they are here. Sure. I mean, I think that that's fairly unlikely. But there are questions about to what degree does it mean to be human? What does that actually mean? And what degree of that is physical? And if we're not Platonists, then we have to at least get into some idea that physicality is part of being a human. Okay, so
yeah,
I can buy that, but then what happens when you're able to transform your humanity? And what happens if we, you know, what if we got to the point where we were able to extend human life, not indefinitely, but say we extended human life to 500 years? And I think that's certainly possible. Not soon, but that's possible someday. Well, what does that mean? Like, because that changes our whole framework of the human experience at that point. And I think that this novel is part of why science fiction in general emerges as an interesting genre in the 20th century is because technology is ramping up and technology is changing the ways that we are human and the ways that we live out our world. And the role of art is always to help us to process those changes and to help us to ask those types of questions. And science fiction at its best is able to not just throw out cool stuff, but do that. And this is a novel that when it comes to the human experience, very much does that and very much challenges us in terms of what will it mean to us as humans when we change? What will it mean if we go down this technological road?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely has, he comes down on firmly on one side of the brain-mind duality.
Right.
Dualism side of things where, you know, a lot of people who are more on the skeptical side are like, nope, there's the brain. And the mind is an emergent property of the brain, and that's it. Where, you know, as Christians, lots of times, and if, as long as we're not physicalists, then we're like, well, there's got to be a soul in there somewhere, too. Is that the mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this whole intangible, there's tons of intangible parts to what it means to be human that you can't capture with slicing and dicing, and you can't capture with pure rationalism. That's not to say those things aren't valuable, but I think that part of where I see a value in a story like this and helping us process those ideas is that he's throwing it out there and saying, what happens when we've essentially become limitless with our technology and what rationality is able to give us? What happens then? And what do we do with the fact that these intangibles start to reassert themselves even in that scenario?
Yeah, and then there's the other part of it, the hierarchy part, right? Where there's
I guess,
and you can correct me here if I'm wrong. The folks who first came to this planet, those are the ones who are now the gods, and everybody down on the planet is their descendants, right?
Correct.
I mean, I guess they're all down on the planet, but
let me say it's a little vague in the book. It's either that where they're all their descendants, or it could be that the gods are the grand poobahs of the ship, and they were the ones who were kind of the ruling class on the ship. And that's a possibility as well in the interpretive framework of the story.
Yeah. You get into some themes about, you know, church and state and the desirability of theocracy.
Right.
And because they're definitely using their godhood, quote godhood, to introduce stability to the planet, to the populace, of course. And that's done by limiting their technological development.
Right.
And so then you have somebody like Sam who comes in here and is a monkey wrench, in the works. And trying to, I think the accelerationist is what it's called, the sect that wants to allow them to have an industrial revolution.
Yep, he's an accelerationist, yep.
And it's interesting to me is because you have both religion as a stabilizing and a destabilizing factor set against each other.
Yeah, and then there's also this question out there of to what degree are these religions true for the people on the planets?
Right.
Because Sam is very adamant that I'm just faking it, but then the lead demon tells him very clearly, no, you are the Buddha, you are the Lord of Light at the end. And Taraka is under no auspicions about what Sam is and what he's doing. But there's, to some extent, there's this tension of truth in the novel where the lie becomes the truth. And for the people living on the planet, these are not the Hindu gods, but they might as well be. And so to what degree is their faith actually true in that sense?
Yeah. Now, can you tell me, is there karma in place and reincarnation for just the general folks, right?
Correct.
Okay. And there's some kind of karma panel that decides, you know, if you're going lower or higher, right?
Yeah, there's beings called the Lord of Karma who, when the people show up for their new body, they get mind scanned. And based on that, it's decided what type of body you're going to go into. That's why Tack of the Archives winds up as an ape for a substantial portion of the novel.
Right.
It's why Sam gets beamed into space. You know, and so you have this kind of body switching thing, and you have these psychic probes that are used for karma. So in a sense, and that's also interesting in terms of that theme of truth, because the Hinduism that they have set up here is far more provable as true than actual Hinduism. And I'm not trying to run down Hinduism any more than any other faith. It's like all faiths have faith, of course. But it's kind of like if in Christianity, where we have the faith of the resurrection. Well, if you could imagine a scenario where people were literally being resurrected after death, and you could see that, that would in some sense be far more tangible and far easier to believe. So the Hinduism that's false is in some sense truer than the Hinduism here on Earth that people would regard as true, and that's unfalsifiable. So there's that interesting dynamic as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that is fascinating. I had a thought and it's gone, Ben. I'm getting old.
Hate it when that happens.
Yeah. Nope. It does not appear to be resurfacing.
Alrighty.
So if you have anything else to talk about.
Well, we could talk about, apparently, I'm reading here on Wikipedia that there is a TV series in the works right now for Lord of Light.
Oh, okay.
So that could be pretty cool. I think TV could really be the way to do this.
Yeah, I think in a lot of senses. I mean, I do another podcast where we only talk about adapted science fiction. And so you can definitely see the weakness of film as a way to adapt entire novels.
Right.
And it can go bad really quickly in a couple of different ways. And we've seen it do that in a lot of different ways.
Yes. But
where with television, it can go bad in other ways, right? There can be. Did you ever see, have you read Childhood's End?
Yes. I didn't see the series, though.
You didn't see it. Okay. So I feel like, in some sense, the fact that they had enough time to tell the whole story meant that they didn't tell it as well as they could have if they had to make some cuts.
Right. Limitations can be a good thing, yeah.
And I couldn't put my finger on what it was that bothered me about it, but there was something in there that I thought, maybe it's just 30 minutes too long, you know, and if you'd had to make some cuts, you could have tightened things up. And so that's my only worry about a limited series or something like American Gods.
Right. Well, yeah, if they do it as a limited series, I mean, it could be an ideal, you know, kind of 10-hour miniseries. Mm-hmm. I would be more concerned if they do it as kind of a Game of Thrones style series where it's going to run for 5-6 years potentially. Right. Which, not to say that couldn't work, because there is a lot unstated in the novel that you could get into. But, you know, as a Game of Thrones viewer, who I won't spoil anything, of course, but as they are well beyond the books at this point, and the show's still fun, but the weaknesses are showing. They're not as good a writers as George R. R. Martin, and you'd have a similar dynamic here. Your writers probably aren't going to be as good a writers as Roger Zelazny. Sure. So you get beyond the book, and what's that going to look like? Mm-hmm. I think, though, given the choice between that and a film, I would go with that, because a film is one of two things are going to happen. They're going to try and keep the structure of the book, and I don't think that would work in a 2 or even a 3 hour movie. It's going to feel too fragmented.
Yeah.
Or they're just going to streamline it, and it'll just kind of be, I didn't see this movie, but what was the Egyptian Gerald Butler movie from a couple years ago? Gods of Egypt. Yeah. No, like that's how I didn't see it, but that's how I imagine this turning out if it goes badly. Like that's worst case scenario. It turns into Gods of Egypt, which the trailer was enough for me on that one.
Oh yeah. Me too. I mean, I think if they did do more than one season, they could have a heck of a cliffhanger at the end of the first season, just on one of the places where Sam gets killed.
Right.
So,
well, yeah. And the interesting thing with TV is they're starting to kind of get to the point where it's not just we're going to run stuff until nobody wants to see it anymore. I mean, Lost was kind of a forerunner on this because that had the end date, but I'm even thinking of The Leftovers, which I was a huge fan of. Mm. It ends after 3 seasons. On the more comedic front, the Vice Principals on HBO is a 2-season run, and it's just that's our story, and that's what we negotiated, and that's what you can do. So that would be a cool possibility, too, of negotiate a 2 or 3 season run for this.
Yeah.
And just when we get to the end of the 3rd season, it doesn't matter if 20 million people are watching every episode and HBO's desperate to do more, we're done.
Yeah. One thing I thought about, moving back to the book from talking about adaptation, is as a Western reader reading this book that's set not in India, but with very Indian themes and the Hindu pantheon, I wonder if some of the impact of the book is greater for a Western reader than it would be for somebody who perhaps came from India.
Yeah, that would be interesting to find out the reaction of somebody who is either a Hindu or was raised in that culture, has been exposed to that culture extensively.
Yeah. I work with a number of folks from India, and so I was talking with some of them about it, and there are so many gods in Hinduism that, you know, I didn't even know the names of half of the ones that were here. You know, I knew the big ones, Shiva and Kali and Brahma.
Yep, Brahma.
But you know, I didn't know about Yama. I didn't know Agni or Mara, just a bunch of them. And I think if, like, when you kind of talk about that adaptation, right, you could extend this, right, and pull in another 10 gods in a second season and tell a different story, but I'm not sure that would work. So.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I always want to do, and I haven't done it yet, but anytime I reread this, I want to go and read some of the great Hindu epics and Hindu mythology and get into some of those. And because I imagine that there's a lot of references there, and you could probably connect some of that. Maybe there's other aspects of Hindu mythology you can throw in there, just to flesh out the story. Or I don't know. I think it's the type of thing where to expand the novel isn't a terrible idea, because there are tons of directions you could go, but it is a dangerous idea because you might suck at it. You know, it's
yeah. And one of the things in the book that was interesting was, you know, Sam does change bodies a couple of times, and you know, and one of those times he basically pulls the wool over everybody's eyes and they think that he's gone, but in fact he's taken on a different body. And to execute that in a television show would be fascinating, because you tend to think of television shows as revolving around stars. You know,
right?
And would you want to have Tyrion Lannister change bodies? You know,
right? Exactly. Yeah, it, you know, throw a mustache on him and call it good, right? It's
just... Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
So, anything else, Ben, you want to talk about this book?
You know, I think that pretty much covers it for what I had in mind. I just love this novel. I love the way it flows. I love the characters. Sam is one of my favorite heroes. I just hope, you know, I imagine a lot of people who haven't read it have bailed for the spoiler section, but if you haven't, go check this out. I think that any fan of sci-fi, this is one of those you need to read.
Yeah.
You know, Matt Anderson, my co-host, who doesn't get into a lot of classic sci-fi, read it and I think enjoyed it. So, it's not a difficult read in the sense that it's not, you're not signing up for 900 pages of math or something where you might in a hard sci-fi. But it is a read that requires something of you. And I think that's a good exercise just in developing yourself as a reader and a appreciator of art as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that'll about wrap it up for us. I'm definitely recommending it as well. I don't think it's my favorite of the ones I've read so far for this podcast, just because, I had an old favorite like Speaker for the Dead, which is my favorite book.
Yeah, that's a great novel too.
And Hyperion and Dune are both amazing too. So,
yeah, you've been getting some of the heavy hitters. So
I have. Yeah,
it's tough to argue with any of those really as a choice for the best.
Yeah, yeah. And I've told people, you know, eventually I'm going to have to be just asking people to come on and pick one of the less favored titles. So
yeah, exactly.
Because there's a lot of stuff from the 50s and 60s that I'm sure people are like, I'm not sure I want to read that.
Well, you can have me on to do Harry Potter, because I will rail for hour upon hour about how Song of Ice and Fire, Storm of Swords lost to Harry Potter. So if you want an alternative type of episode, an angry episode,
there we
can
go.
Do that.
Nice. Yeah, there's only one Harry Potter winner.
Yes.
And I guess I didn't look at what the competition was that year. But
yeah, George R. R. Martin lost to Harry Potter. In fact, the best George R. R. Martin book, the best one in A Song of Ice and Fire, lost to Harry Potter.
Well, and it's not like The Goblet of Fire is the best of that series either.
No, exactly. It's fine. Like, yeah. I don't hate Harry Potter, but it's fine. You know, whereas Storm of Swords is one of the finest fantasy novels ever written.
Now, what number is that in the...
That's number three.
Number three, okay. I've only read the first one, and epic fantasy isn't really my thing, and so...
Sure.
So I read it, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it was... I liked the fact that... I'm not a big fan of all the world building. Like in Tolkien, he does a ton of world building.
Right.
It's kind of dry sometimes. Where I felt like Martin did it much more skillfully, kind of through character viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, at some point I might pick up a couple more of those. But,
yeah.
You know, I can drag my feet for years probably and still they won't all be out. So.
Yeah, shut up. We've been suffering for years.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, I started reading the series around the time Storm of Swords came out, and I've got two more books since then. Like, that was 2001, so,
ouch. You know,
half my life is gone waiting for this stupid series to get finished.
Well, Ben, I really want to thank you for coming on and doing this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, and, you know, down the line, we can look at having you back after I've had enough guests that I feel like I can do repeats.
Perfect. Yeah, I'd be happy to do one of those lesser-known ones, too, even if I haven't read it yet. It's always fun to kind of dig into that old sci-fi and figure out what was popular back then.
Yeah, and I don't want to twist anybody's arm. I'd like to keep it more volunteer basis. You know, well, I'd like to read this book because I want to have people come on who have passion about a title.
Yeah. Well, you know me. I'll get one way or another. You'll get passion.
That is true. Yeah.
There aren't a lot of books I'll land on a middle ground with. So, right.
Yes. Ben, let's talk about heroes.
Yeah. Heroes in Disney World. Let's go.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and Colin, my Take Me to Your Reader co-host, has volunteered to kind of go back and take the earlier ones.
So. Okay.
Good so deal. He said, just let me know when you need me to start reading, what is it, The Forever Machine.
I've actually read that one. I don't remember it, but there was a time when I was going to read through the Hugos all in a row, and I think I got through four of them before I gave up that project, but I did read The Forever Machine once upon a time.
Yeah, and that's why I set out to do this in a more random order. I didn't want to be bogged down in some of the early stuff.
Yeah, I think that's smart.
You know, it can be delightful, but it can also not be delightful.
Well, and it's the same type of thing year after year after year, and yeah, you can get discouraged in the project pretty quick that way, whereas bouncing around lets you get some variety and styles and all that.
Yep. And like I said, I will have Matt on at some point in the near future, because I've already read Red Shirts and I think he's been listening to it, so
I think I know he's read it at this point, so
yeah. Well, before you sign off, how can people get a hold of you if they want to?
Go out to thescifichristian.com. Check us out there. You check us out on Facebook, Twitter, on YouTube. We do Game of Thrones reviews over on YouTube that are fun, and then trying to do a little bit more. Matt's not doing this with me out on YouTube, but I have a friend who wants to get into classic movies. So about once a month, we're going out there and we're going to watch a classic that he hasn't seen before and I have, and we'll kind of get his reaction as somebody who's not really used to watching that type of movie. So we're going to be watching The Third Man tomorrow. It's not necessarily sci-fi stuff, but that should be a fun series as well.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll put all those links in the show notes so that people can get a hold of you.
Perfect. I'll look and see if I can find that Jack Kirby artwork link, because it's pretty cool. And I'll send you a link so you can put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right. Well, thanks for joining me, Ben. And I hope we get to talk down the line.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Ben. And I hope you'll check out his podcast, The Sci-Fi Christian. I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. In the effort to keep these things a little more evergreen, I'm not going to continue to actually say what I'm doing next, but I will encourage you to follow me on social media, on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast, and also follow me on Goodreads. You can find me goodreads.com/Hugo's Podcast, and you'll be able to see what I'm currently reading, and that'll be your clue as to what the homework might be. And of course, I invite you to share this with your friends, like us on Facebook, give us a review any place that you listen to it, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. I'd really, really appreciate that. And if you want to contact me, you can do that through email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. And I think that'll about do it for this time, so we'll talk to you next time. Bye.